Stew.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Carl Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Well, don't be sniffy about
I'm not
pens.
Being sniffy.
No, I think you are.
No, no.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
as for the Constitution, so too for Star Wars.
Everyone at the farmer's market probably thought we were psychotic.
And that was a total psychological marathon.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
If only you could be so bold.
The Imperial Senate will not sit still for this. When they hear you've attacked...
How dare the press not believe me that I went after my mother with a hammer!
That was from a fantastic viral video that came out earlier in this 2016 presidential cycle with, of course, Donald Trump as Darth Vader. But the idea of Star Wars raising issues of morality and social philosophy and issues of consequence is really no joke. Those kinds of issues are at the heart of the Star Wars movies a lot. And that is what a new book is about. It's called The World According to Star Wars. The author of The World According to Star Wars is not the sort of person you'd expect. I don't think he's ever been to a Comic-Con convention. He's not a big pop culture commentator. He is Cass Sunstein, who is this name brand legal scholar, maybe the most famous legal scholar at this point in America, and a former Obama administration official.
Recently confirmed, regulatory czar Cass Sunstein.
The man who put many of the Obama administration's regulations in place.
The most dangerous man in America. Cass Sunstein.
The most dangerous man in America. I love that. And of course, you heard some right-wing people demonizing him, but the left also hated a lot of what Cass was about. Some people were surprised when he came out with this strange outlier of a book. I was not, because I went to college with Cass Sunstein around the time the original Star Wars movie came out. And back then, he wasn't just going home to his dorm room to read the Federalist Papers. He was, along with me, an editor of our college humor magazine, the Harvard Lampoon. So when he sat down to talk with me about this new Star Wars book, I couldn't help but yank his chain a little bit. Does this queer your Supreme Court nomination, like defending your talk about the Siths in front of a Senate committee?
I think the book has increased my chances by maybe a thousandfold. I think everyone loves Star Wars, so if you wanted to get on the Supreme Court, the thing to do really is to write a book about Star Wars.
Well, the first one, of course, came out when we were young and you were in law school. Have you been a consistent Star Wars nerd since then?
Not really. So then I liked Star Wars. I liked A New Hope plenty. Maybe I liked it a ton. I liked Empire Strikes Back even better, and I liked Return of the Jedi. But my becoming a Star Wars-focused person is extremely recent, and it's prompted by my now 7-year-old son, who improbably at the age of 5 became very focused on Star Wars, and that got me very curious about the whole phenomenon.
Was there, as you rewatched them as a middle-aged person with your son, was there a particular scene that made you go, whoa, I'd forgotten how important this is?
Yeah, the scene that kind of knocked my socks off is the scene where Luke almost kills his dad.
Never. I'll never turn to the dark side. You failed, Your Highness. I am a Jedi, like my father before me.
That's a very moving line. And if you think about the context where what Luke is doing is he's identifying with his dad, who's the worst person in the universe except for the Emperor.
Yeah.
And he's kind of claiming him. And he's also saying that his father's a Jedi, not a Sith. And that's a statement of trust and connection that in the context of fighting and lightsabers, it runs pretty deep.
So you're Cass Sunstein. When you announced to your peers at Harvard Law School and in government that, I'm writing this Star Wars book, how did they react?
Negative. They thought this was a really bad idea, and they hoped it was like you wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to work on this, but by the afternoon, you get over it. So my friends thought this was likely to be an unsuccessful book in the sense that no one would publish it, and also likely to be a diversion of focus from the footnotes and the law review articles.
Yeah.
A kind of self-indulgent pursuit of an interest that would be not worthy of using word processing time on.
Get rid of those people. They're squares. They're stiffs. Although it's not, you know, so unlike your other work in that it is about social and legal and political philosophy, but placed in the context of this pop cultural, drag.
You're right. There is a connection between Star Wars and episode creation. Bear with me here, if you would, and law. And that's the first thing that drew me in. So I Am Your Father is a way of making everyone go, whoa, because what they had thought before is completely in a new light. And that's both shocking and also can produce a sense of immediate recognition. That's it. That's right.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough. He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
And so the woe of I Am Your Father is, I think, very arresting. And laws like that, too. When the Supreme Court struck down racial segregation in 1954, really, that wasn't spooling out what anyone who wrote the Constitution's provisions thought. That was an I Am Your Father moment of the best kind.
So just so that listeners are clear, you're saying in the same way that epical milestone Supreme Court decisions, people didn't see it necessarily coming.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if Darth Vader had said, not I am your father, but I am R2-D2, or yeah. I am your cat, or I'm just your dream, then that would have been shark jumping. It would have made the whole narrative stupid. And certainly conservatives think that the Supreme Court's upholding the Affordable Care Act was a I am R2-D2 moment. And it's legitimate to argue both for episodes and for in a narrative, including Star Wars, and in law, you know, are we making sense of our tradition or are we turning it into nonsense?
I was thinking about the Star Wars universe and how it's pretty black and white and the good guys are pretty totally good and the bad guys are definitely totally bad. And your work is so much about nuance and ambiguity, and as a result, people on the right and left hate you with great passion equally. There is no Cass Sunstein equivalent in the Star Wars universe, is there?
I actually see things a little differently.
I'm sure you do.
The way I see Star Wars is that the person who restores balance to the Force, the chosen one, the person who commits the most heroic act ever is Darth Vader.
Luke, help me take this mask off.
He is the chosen one. He is the one who sacrifices everything, not just his life, but his life's cause, in order to do one thing, save his child.
Go, my son.
No, you're coming with me. I'll not leave you here. I've got to save you.
You already have, Luke.
And his soul is saved, no question about that. And it's not that that's random. His son thought all along, there is good in you, and was right. So I think the movie looks a lot simpler in terms of good versus evil than it actually is. It's saying that in the worst of us, there is good, which can lead to redemptive acts of the highest order. And the best of us, if you don't go dark, you're not human.
Well put. And now I have to go watch the movies again and think about them in this more serious, deep and thoroughgoing way that you have. A few years ago, you co-wrote a book called Nudge about how governments need to be something between nanny states and laissez-faire, do-nothing entities, and to nudge people into making better decisions because they make bad decisions on their own. In this book, I was interested that you say that theory could be applied to Jedi Knights. Explain that.
It can. So you could say that Jedi Knights have a talent not just to move objects, but also to affect minds. And the way they can do that is manipulate people's attention.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
He can go about his business.
You can go about your business.
But magicians, and Jedi Knights are in some respects magicians, can do exactly that without any supernatural powers. What they can do is draw your attention to, you know, the right hand when the left hand is doing something that seems magical if you're not looking at it. And what some of the behavioral economics has shown is that our attention is a very limited commodity, and sometimes we won't see things that are even in front of our eyes. And that applies not just to magic stuff, but to behavioral efforts by, let's say, self-interested companies to manipulate us by making sure we don't see that even though the refrigerator doesn't cost so much up front, there are going to be ancillary charges that are going to be big, and also to run the refrigerator for the next year is going to be super expensive. And governments, when they're working well, I think, often are trying to expand people's attention so that they see aspects of a transaction that really matter their lives, like calories. That's a nudge, calorie label.
So those are just Jedi mind tricks presented in a boring way.
Yes. And they are, I think they're not so much mind tricks. They're a little more, as you say, boring. But they are designed to make sure that you aren't, let's say, confounded by Jedi mind tricks. So they're counteracting a mind trick.
You are a defender of the terrible Star Wars movies that came out, or the movies that I and many people think are terrible. Is that because that they expand this story that you talk about of, oh, Darth Vader is not all terrible, Luke is not all good? Because they do have bad acting and bad dialogue, for instance.
Well, let's say a few things that might also be true.
Okay.
I can't deny what you just said, but The Revenge of the Sith is a terrific movie. The way that Anakin Skywalker's fall to the dark side mirrors Luke's refusal to fall, that's kind of beautiful and very precise. The dialogue is almost the same in some of the scenes. And what Lucas pulls off is that detachment is the Yoda theme, both in the original trilogy and the prequels. You have to be detached.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
But both Anakin's refusal to be detached in the prequels and Anakin's refusal to be detached in the original trilogy, that leads to his killing, and It leads to his redemption.
You're somebody who obviously cares about the nature and survival of democracy and the rule of law and all that. I can imagine that another thing that interested you in the middle movies was the other big storyline, which is this republic turning into a fascist empire.
Yeah, that's grown on me, I should say. When I first saw the prequels, I reacted, I think, like a lot of people, which is, you know, why don't we get to something interesting? But it holds up really well. And I think not just because we live in a time when, let's say, strongmen are having appeal in both Europe and the United States.
You mean the Republicans have just nominated Emperor Palpatine?
Well, I wouldn't say that. But I would say that Mr. Trump, whether you like him or don't like him, some of his appeal is he's going to knock some heads. The niceties don't matter to him in the way they standardly do. The idea that we have a broken, paralyzed legislative process and we need someone who can set things right, Trump's appeal has something to do with that. And in Europe, we're seeing that as well. And so I think Lucas did get right that dynamic.
Uh-huh.
And it's not a coincidence or a prophecy on his part. He studied history, and he particularly studied Nazi Germany and Napoleon's France, and saw how a broken or blocked legislature can often breed a real challenge, a serious challenge, to democratic forms.
The Republic will be reorganized into the First Galactic Empire!
So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
But it's an interesting question about whether what the United States of America in this day and age is in the Star Wars scheme, because we all like to think of ourselves as the part of the Rebel Alliance, of course. Yet, are we more the Empire or more the Rebel Alliance in 2016?
We're a republic, so I agree with you that the question who is what is something that the Star Wars movies provocatively and deliberately pose. And Lucas, when he did the original ones, he's on record as saying he saw the Empire as the United States. Now, it's not a didactic thing. My view of the United States is, you know, Benjamin Franklin said after the Constitution was drafted in response to a question on the spot, what have you given us? And he said, a republic if you can keep it.
This is not just a book that you wrote out of your head. You obviously did research. Did you discover things that surprised you about how these movies came to be?
Very much so. So I had believed the account, which has been offered publicly, which is that George Lucas had figured out the arc of the narrative at a very early stage, and he just kind of spooled it out. But what I learned from doing the research, and I read basically, you know, 12 drafts or partial drafts of A New Hope and corresponding numbers of at least the total for the others, is that the big plot twists were relatively late developments. So the idea that Darth Vader was supposed to be Luke's dad from the beginning, nope. Originally, in fact, Darth Vader was a really minor character and Luke was old, so that couldn't be. Uh-huh. So Lucas's improvisation and kind of on-the-spot movements completely surprised me, stunned me in view of what people think.
So in other words, you're not an originalist. I guess none of us should be originalists when it comes to Star Wars.
No. So as for the Constitution, so too for Star Wars, there's a lot of improvisation on the spot.
Well, and you say in the book, in fact, about the Constitution, that the debates, the endless debates among Star Wars fans and nerds are useful and are like constitutional debates.
Completely. So when we talk about whether the Constitution protects the right to same-sex marriage, now the right to polygamy, whether it protects against surveillance, or whether to interpret it that way is foolish and ridiculous, that's like the Star Wars fans' debates over, you know, did Han shoot first? Is are the movies actually secretly on the side of Emperor Palpatine? Those are all kind of like our constitutional debates.
When you get on the court, you can make all the other eight people have these very conversations, and that will be when they start televising, I guess, Supreme Court decisions.
Maybe.
Thank you very much, Cass. This was just a pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Kurt. Good to talk.
Cass Sunstein's fascinating little book, The World According to Star Wars, is out now.
Studio 360.
Imagine this. It's the morning. You wake up. And then, pretty soon, you find that everything you're experiencing was curated just for you.
Past and present, but before all that, good morning, Kurt Anderson.
Not only where you go, but just about everything you see, everybody you meet, everything that happens during this day. For this day, for this one day, you are the main character in a play that's taking place in the real world, probably the real world that you occupy. And you are the only person in it who doesn't have a script. There's this theater company called Odyssey Works that does this. Liz Mack was recruited for the cast of one of these bespoke happenings in San Francisco, and here's how it went.
I was checking my inbox one day when I got an email from Odyssey Works.
It said to show up at the DeYoung Museum of Art on a Saturday at 2:45. It said, come wearing all black. I'm part of this latest production, along with 40 or so other people, and we don't know who it's for yet, except for this. She's the type of person who could sit in front of a painting for an hour. The email said, we want to see if a group of people could spend that hour with her, seeing art the way she does. We're all here to be part of a different kind of museum tour.
My name is Dare Turner.
She's the participant in today's Odyssey. It's an entire event that's been created just for her. This moment at the museum is one of the final scenes in her day-long adventure. And it's a real-life staging of a dream that she's had for a long time, to start a new kind of museum, one with only a handful of pieces.
So if you go to the museum, instead of seeing all the greatest hits and seeing 10 different objects in an hour and then fleeing, you might just go and sit with one piece.
Turner's the artistic type, but she also has a business side and had been working as an office administrator. It's kind of like she has two separate lives, and she was conflicted with it. And that tension, that's something her Odyssey pressed upon. Odyssey Works has been around for more than a decade. And during that time, they've sent people on all kinds of journeys. They've made a participant walk the length of Manhattan while carrying a heavy rock. They've wrapped another in a cocoon overnight. She woke up the next morning in a field of butterflies.
We study a person for months and months and months.
That's Abraham Bjerkson, the director of Odyssey Works. He says the artists behind the productions, they do their homework.
We've spoken to their mother and their lover and their husband and their wife and their boss, and we've gone to the place where they work and we've dug through their house and everything.
They start with a call for applications. And to figure out who they'll choose for one of their two or so annual productions, they ask people to answer all sorts of questions.
Tell us the story of your life, or how do you feel about your mother? What is your relationship to sexuality? What is your favorite color?
For some people, the application can take up to 10 hours to complete. Then there can be months of interviews until that one person is selected. But Turner's a special case, because Bjerkson commissioned this Odyssey himself, and he happens to be her boyfriend. And Turner had no idea what was about to happen. Here's how her Odyssey started. Turner was shopping at the farmer's market, and she stopped to visit a friend who sells apples there.
And she said, oh, I have something for you. I have a gift for you.
She hands Turner a pouch. Inside, there's a coin. It says Homer on it, in Greek.
And then I flipped the coin over and saw ships on the back, and like, oh gosh, these must have been the ships that Odysseus used on his Odyssey.
That's when five of her closest friends come running over, all wearing pink onesies.
And they were yelling and screaming, and then they came up to me and all gave me hugs, and then blindfolded me and put a blanket over my head and walked me out to the car. And everyone at the farmer's market probably thought we were psychotic.
In the car, Turner's friends start talking about their baby nieces and nephews and this childlike wonder they all have, a conversation crafted for Turner to take note. And then they get to their next destination, a fenced-off, run-down area, broken glass everywhere. They pull off the plywood and wave her inside.
Hey, come here. Come here. And so I climbed through the fence and found myself in an abandoned rose garden that was completely, like, totally abandoned for years and years.
Her friends have set up a picnic, and everyone shares something they prepared for Turner. They bring persimmons, her favorite fruit. One friend reads Oscar Wilde, one of her favorite writers.
Beauty is a form of genius, is higher indeed than genius, as it needs no explanation.
After the picnic, Turner's given instructions to walk to a cafe. That's when she starts to question, what's reality and what's part of the production?
Is that Stranger? Like, is he the one with the bikes? Maybe we're supposed to ride bikes together. You know, I'm just like, or maybe it's that guy walking dogs. Like, I wonder if he's here for me. The Odyssey makes you question the reality of everything and, you know, or the wonder of everything.
At the cafe, she's met by another friend. They walk until they get to a firefighter training facility, and they start to play a game. Turner's friend asks her to imagine the things she might save in case of a fire.
And that was a very, like, weirdly eye-opening experience, too, in that I chose things that I didn't naturally think I would have chosen.
Like, instead of her laptop with all her precious work files, she chooses her grandma's handkerchiefs. And that surprises her.
I was much more taken with the sentimental objects and the things that represented something to me that wasn't necessarily practical, but was equally, if not more, valuable.
For Bjerkson, the director of Odyssey Works, these moments are the whole point, to deeply move the participant.
We want somebody not just to look at what we've done and say that's great, but to go so deep into it that they are part of the work and that they are changed by the work. If a person isn't changed by an Odyssey Works performance, maybe we didn't try hard enough.
People have been changed by the performances. They've quit their jobs. They've ended relationships. Before Turner leaves the firehouse, she's given a key with a map, which takes her to a house she doesn't recognize. There's a letter on the living room table telling her about a fire in the mission that took place last year that consumed this very block and barely missed the house she's in. The letter talks about the one possession the owner of the house took, what she valued in case of a fire. It was a stroller to get her baby to safety. From there, Turner goes to an empty field in Golden Gate Park, where she finds the owner of the house waiting for her. She's hung up several empty frames and suspended them from trees. The woman tells Turner to take a look through them. What did you see when you were looking through each frame?
I think I saw my future, in a way.
What she saw was that she could make her dream of creating an intimate exhibition with a handful of pieces, each carefully chosen. That kind of eye-opening exhibition could actually happen. That's the inspiration behind this Odyssey, which brings us back to the initial email I received, asking me and those 40 other people to be here at the De Young Museum, all dressed in black. We focus on three pieces in the museum. Our job as actors is to look at art the way she does, walk up to it, look behind it, from up close and then from afar, to help her envision her dream.
After the entire experience, I walked away from my Odyssey with two words. I'm ready. I'm ready to engage with the arts as my career. I'm ready to explore these different ideas. I'm ready to experiment and experience, more importantly. I'm not afraid anymore. I'm ready.
Standing in the museum, I'm still absorbed by one of Turner's favorite pieces, Cornelia Parker's Anti-Mass. It's a piece made up of scraps of burnt, blackened wood suspended in the air. And all of us who've come to be a part of the production, we stand scattered around the room, all staring at it for a full half hour. And with all of us dressed in black, it feels like the piece itself expands to include us, too. I don't even notice when Turner leaves. She's whisked away to the final part of her journey, a party deep in the woods where all her friends will greet her, still dressed in their onesies.
That is Liz Mack in San Francisco. A version of her story appeared earlier on KALW's Cross Currents. Odyssey Works does only like a couple of those a year. So naturally, if you want to commission them to do this for somebody you know, it'll cost you up to $70,000. But if anybody is listening who knows me and wants to do one for me, I'm down with it. By the way, Dare Turner did change her life after her Odyssey Works experience. She quit her job as an office administrator, moved across the country to Baltimore, and is now getting her master's degree in art history. Next up.
I feel like I'm the worst band member in a certain way because I like things the way that I like them.
The singer-songwriter Margaret Glaspie admits to me that she is a control freak.
I won't say that I'm not a team player, but...
Right. As long as you run the team.
As long as I'm running the team, it's fine.
She'll perform live, just her, in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
We get a whole bunch of new records by artists we don't know here in Studio 360 every week, and it's a pleasure to go through them. Every now and then, I hear one that I really love, and this is one of those. It's a new record by an artist named Margaret Glaspie. She grew up in a small town in Northern California in a very musical family. She played Texas-style fiddle, really seriously played it, also played trombone in the school band, and now she sings and plays guitar, and that's what her new album, her first album, is all about. It's called Emotions and Math.
No matter who got you down, even the weakest of the weak have come around.
So I asked her to come in all by herself without that band and play for us. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
And before we talk at length and in depth, will you play a song?
I would be happy to. This will be Emotions and Math.
Which is the title song of this album.
Yes, the great title track of the
great
record.
Let's hear Emotions and Math.
Okay, great.
Side. Oh, everything's alright. It's just when you're gone, I start to snooze the alarm, 'cause I stay up until 4 in the morning, counting all the days till you're back. I'm shivering in an ice cold bath of emotions and mad. Oh, it's a shame and I'm to blame, 'cause we're alright until you go and I start losing control without warning, counting all the days till you're back. I'm shivering in an ice cold bath of emotions and mad. I've got to get out of this tree or off of this limb. I'm a woman acting like a kid, a skinny mess that's breathless from telling you all the things that I'm gonna do. This limb, I'm a woman acting like a kid, a skinny mess that's breathless from telling you all the things that I'm gonna do.
That was Margaret Glaspie singing and playing the guitar on Emotions and Math, which is the title song of her new album. And I should tell the listeners that here we are in the beautiful Jerome L. Green Performance Space, a place where concerts are held, and here we are with virtually no audience.
So, virtually no audience.
So You wrote and performed every song on this album.
Yep, and produced.
And produced it. Why did you do everything? What made you want to do the whole thing?
I mean, it just, because I was doing all of it, I suppose. And any time that I'd kind of consider bringing someone else on, it just never quite made sense because I knew what I wanted already. It just felt like it was just going to get in the way if someone else was involved. Like when I was making iPad demos of the record, that was a large part of the production process. Because that entire time I wanted to make it so that I didn't need to wait for other people to put things on there. So that meant that I had to write the songs in a way that they were already complete without other band members. My goal was to try and make the songs as bulletproof as possible. Uh-huh. So I didn't have to, I could perform them solo and still feel like they were complete.
I'm just curious, again, as the person, as the performer, writer, producer, you're in for these 3 days, you're in the head of, I'm performing. I have to perform these. But that's not a separate kind of brain condition than the technical production aspect?
It was challenging at times.
Yeah.
You know, I would at times question myself and I'd say, I can't be in the booth and playing at the same time.
Exactly.
And I would get really frustrated with that. That's certainly a frustration of me wanting to produce my own records and knowing that I can't be two places at once.
Yeah.
And I did the vocal completely by myself with just the engineer and me and no one else in around. And that was like a total psychological marathon in this crazy way of, you know, taking notes in front of myself on the music stand at right directly after a take so I could catch, you know, what I liked about it and listening back to them and really producing myself in that way that was so hands-on.
And your first serious instrument was the fiddle?
Yeah. That was the first, like, serious instrument. I played, you know, other things. I played the trombone when I was in elementary, middle school. I played school band.
At what age are you this cute little fiddler?
I was in third grade when I started to play the fiddle.
Oh. But you were serious. And I didn't know that there's this big national competition circuit of child fiddlers.
Yeah, the national and adults, the national old-time fiddle competition.
Right, I'd heard the old-time fiddle. So at some point you decide, oh, there's the guitar. I can do that?
Yeah, I mean, my whole family, there's quite a love of guitars. I remember several guitars always being around the house, and there still are.
Your dad, your mom?
Both my dad and my mom are super musical. My dad's always played guitar since we were young. My mom is more recently got really into the guitar and plays some fiddle too. My brother plays guitar really well. My sister plays. I'm not special in that regard in my family. Everyone's super musical, for
and,
sure.
And that's when you're a teenager? When did you start playing guitar?
Kind of more seriously when I was probably about 15 or 16. I would start to kind of learn the progressions that would go behind Texas-style fiddle music. And then from that, and some of those chord voicings are actually kind of, they're kind of tricky.
Harder than rock and roll?
Well, there's old-time fiddle. I won't get too into it because you could talk about this forever, but there's an old-time fiddle and then there's Texas-style fiddle. And from going from one to another, the guitar actually got kind of progressively more jazz-influenced and a little trickier.
You mean in the history of that?
Yeah, and in the kind of style, backup style guitar. Huh. And so I started to kind of wrap my head around these kind of jazz chords and passing chords, and then I kind of started to put down the fiddle, and I didn't really care anymore about playing that music, and instead I just wanted to play the guitar all the time.
Well, there's also presumably more ways to go
exactly.
being a guitarist than being an old-time fiddler.
Exactly. And yeah, I have a lot of respect for that music, and it's an amazing tradition. But at the same time, my brain was kind of itching for other things, for sure.
Well, let's hear another one of these songs that you wrote and that you will sing and then that you will play from Emotions and Math. Which will this be?
This is going to be a song called Situation.
Great.
Take your hands off of me. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't like sympathy. Don't you dare pity me, 'cause you don't know my situation. We've had at most one conversation. Don't come out of the blue and tell me what to do. Sure, I show up looking my worst, make a point and curse, and you think you're gonna be the first to change my ways after the day, but you don't know my situation. We've had at most one conversation. You haven't got a clue, so don't tell me what to do. politician. Call me a rebel, call me a renegade, whatever fits the mold you made. 'Cause you all know my situation, we've had it most one conversation. You haven't got a clue, so don't tell me what to do. One conversation, you haven't got a clue, so don't tell me what to do.
That was Margaret Glaspie playing Situation off her new album Emotions and Math. I'm always curious about singers and the differences between their singing voice and their speaking voice.
Interesting.
I mean, they're different. How you sound as you sing is different from the voice as you're speaking to me now. How conscious of a creation is your singing voice?
I think it's just as conscious as any artistic style, I suppose. You know, I've always sung in some kind of way that's reminiscent of the way I'm singing right now. So at a young age, I think I kind of yelled. It was really loud when I would sing. And then from there, I feel like I've just been carving it down into what it is now.
Yeah,
I mean, it is certainly cultivated in the same way that everyone's art is kind of, you've got
a
style.
No, there's the country bit to your voice. You were a vocal studies major when you attended the Berklee School of Music in Boston, not a guitar student, not a violin student, because at that point you decided that's what I need to work on?
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to who I thought I was at the time. I feel like I was a singer. I wasn't as good at guitar or as active at the guitar as I am now. I thought that you were supposed to kind of sing jazz standards in order to get into Berklee. I kind of catered to it in a certain way because I didn't quite understand that you could go in there and just sing songs and be yourself. That's kind of what Berklee is about in a certain way. So I kind of applied as a vocalist and did that for only a semester. I was only there for a semester and had a grant to go there for that time.
If somebody had written you a check for $200,000, would you have stayed for 4 years?
I probably wouldn't have stayed for 4 years. I may have stayed for another year or a couple of years, but my ticket to get over to the East Coast, which I'd always wanted to do at a young age, was going to school.
So last year you appeared on this very interesting album with the banjo player Jamie Stone, which is you and he in a collaboration of other musicians reworking songs recorded in the field by the famous Alan Lomax in the 1930s and 40s, which you and they rearranged and reinterpreted. I want to play a clip from one of the tracks, which features you on vocals.
I want to hear somebody play. I want to hear somebody play. Somebody pray. Oh, I want to hear somebody pray down in the valley over yonder. I want to hear somebody pray.
So that song and that music on that album is very different from what you write.
Yes.
And what you do. How did it feel to be in this other mode?
I was involved in that project for about 2 years. And for me to play that music, it's a very large stretch actually from what I'm doing now. I learned how to essentially be on the road and see what that felt like. Mm-hmm. And I had never really toured extensively before. And also just learned so much about music history in that project.
It sounds like it was another year or two of school.
Exactly. I just learned so much about what I crave in my own music and also about collaborating with other people. I mean, I feel like I'm the worst band member in a certain way because I like things the way that I like them. And
says the woman who produces her record and won't let them give her a producer.
I won't say that I'm not a team player, but
as long as you run the team.
As long as I'm running the team, it's fine.
Will you play us one more song before you leave this empty theater?
Yes, I will.
And this song is You and I?
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, tonight I'm a little too turned on to talk about us. And tomorrow I'll be too turned off and won't give a what about you and I don't want to see you cry, but it feels like a matter of time. I'm not looking for an open door to talk about love. Maybe you agree, but I see you saving pictures of you and I don't want to see you cry, but it feels like a matter of time. Here I thought we had some kind of understanding that we're no Dick and Jane out on parade. Not looking for lengthy or demanding. Nothing's lost if nothing's gained. Just a smile of kisses, just a kiss. So I see you all the while reading into it. No, there's no you and I don't wanna see you cry, but it feels like a matter of time. I think you might be harboring a heartache. I think you might be crying when I'm gone. Been a mistake, I let linger too long.
That is Margaret Glaspie playing a tune from her new album Emotions and Math, which is out now. And we're out now as well. But we'll be back with a new show next week. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team's pretty easy to spot because every one of them are
wearing pink onesies.
They are
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Tommy Bazarian,
Kate Essig,
Kestrel Wolgemuth,
Joaquin Kotler,
Juliet Muller,
Emily Marinoff,
and I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening.
Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the writer Juno Diaz paid attention to Judy Blume when he was a kid for a very particular reason.
Of course, because if you're a teenage boy, you're thinking, oh, my sister's reading this. This is going to be a map for
I can learn
future
something.
Conquest. You know?
Coming of age, that's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.